He was triumphant, the tremble euphoric. We got to the entrance of my building and he stopped as though to take leave. "I'll make us some tea," I said. And it was all the permission he needed to speak.
"Are you okay?"
he asked.
"I'm okay," I said, fumbling with the key to the building lock. "That man came, he just came out of nowhere and attacked you from behind. If I hadn't... But you... How are you feeling?"
I swung open the building's gate.
"I just don't want you to be frightened,"
he continued, and it was clear to any American girl that he wanted me to be frightened.
"I just don't want you to be upset. I'd never let anyone upset you. I'd never let a woman that I... any woman that I know be humiliated like that,"
he said. And he was watching me earnestly in the elevator mirror, hoping I would be humiliated like that. He was a shade darker than I had remembered him being, and his cheekbones glinted beneath the light like two scissored boning knives. I pulled apart the accordion door of the elevator and stepped out of confinement, feeling him follow.
"I don't feel humiliated. He was drunk, and also clearly," I began to say, unlocking the front door of my apartment, but he cut me off. "So anyone who's drunk can grab you and you're fine with it?"
I kicked off my shoes and left him at the entrance to shut the door behind him. And my English brain knew that in Arabic he'd be offended at having to follow me into my own home and close the door behind himself while I walked off. If we had still been together, he would never have allowed it. He would have shouted for me to come back and answer him, or he would have left the door open so I'd have to close it myself. But his new position was fragile and uncertain. My English brain didn't want to cede any ground just yet. There are calculations that precede thought. There are protective measures that one recognizes as protective only retrospectively. I defended myself with an instinct that was not there before. The man barked. "He wasn't only drunk, he was unwell," I announced in the kitchen as I flicked on the kettle and brought down mugs from the cupboard. How to say mental health in Arabic? "Sick. He looked sick. And anyway, he didn't hurt me." I brought out two tea bags and their strings wound around each other. They wouldn't let go. He could not contain himself.
"I've never met anyone as cold as you. You're not human. You're not even a woman. A stranger attacked you and you're not even upset. I'm still shaking and you..."
I spooned out the sugar, then opened the fridge door for a sprig of fresh mint.
This is a drinking game. The first person asks the second, "Wanna buy a dog?" The second person asks the first, "It barks?" The first person tells the second, "It barks." The second person asks the third, "Wanna buy a dog?" The third person asks the second, "It barks?" The second person asks the first, "It barks?" The first person tells the second, "It barks." The second person tells the third, "It barks." The third person asks the fourth, "Wanna buy a dog?" The fourth person asks the third, "It barks?" The third person asks the second, "It barks?" The second person asks the first, "It barks?" The first person tells the second, "It barks." The second person tells the third, "It barks." The third person tells the fourth, "It barks." If there is no fifth person for the fourth person to ask, he asks the first, "Wanna buy a dog?" This is an Egyptian drinking game, not an American drinking game, with cards and ping pong balls. In America, no one wants to buy a dog. All the dogs are rescued. The buses and trains drive themselves, and when an ambulance comes through, everyone moves out of the way. You can be a woman or a man or neither in America. All the parks are free, and they restrict the nicotine content in their cigarettes to protect their citizens from addiction. You can be stabbed to death on a street surrounded by people, and no one will help you. You can be molested by a stranger in public, and then get up, go home, and make tea, remembering how many sugars everyone takes, and to save the tea bags as food for the houseplants, putting them on an upturned jar lid by the sink. Because one use is not enough in America. They must also be disemboweled and buried in dirt. Footnote. Slums in Cairo are often dependent for survival on the waste of wealthier adjacent neighborhoods who consider it good ethic to throw away clean bags of food. Even tea bags are dug out of the trash and reused, just as cigarette stubs are collected and sucked down to the filter. It is considered selfish for those with useful trash to repurpose it themselves.
And then, just as I came to pour the hot water, he spoke in a voice that was smaller than I'd heard it in my mind all these months. His child voice. The voice he used in bed when all the lights were out, and he wanted to ask me something threatening to himself. He said, "Did you ever love me?" I wasn't prepared for this, and the water scalded me. I missed the mugs entirely. Behind my back, I felt the kitchen empty of him, and I remembered suddenly, and for no clear reason, that he loved Fernando Pessoa, the films of Volker Schlondorf, Wim Wenders, and Jacques Rivette, the ballooning childish portraits of Jean Dubuffet's early works, particularly Woman Grinding Coffee, which he had printed on a little card in his wallet. I remembered how he could date any photo you showed him that had been developed within the country, based on the quality of paper and ink. I remembered how he knew all the street kids on Champollion by name, and how they came to him for candy and sometimes gave him things, stickers, broken toys, a miniature bottle of glitter nail polish which he happily painted on his thumbnail. What have I done? What have I turned him into, and what else have I forgotten? I went out to find him, and he was sitting sideways on the wooden chair of the dining table, hunched over. He jumped up when he saw me, and when I approached with my arms outstretched, he quickly stepped back with a panic I didn't recognize. "It's me," I said, taking another step forward. "Please," he said, looking down at his coat. "I don't want to get you dirty. Something was wrong." "I don't care," I smiled snappily, taking another step forward. "Please, can I just shower first? I don't want—" And then I smelled what he was saying and shrugged, pretending not to understand. I brought him a fresh towel and some of my own clothes, and he was in the bathroom for a long time with the hot water running.
I spent the night, not because I saved her, but because she saved me. She fed me, she clothed me in her two short pants, and made me a blanket nest on the couch that now faced a coffee table instead of armchairs. All the dining furniture was in the living room, and the couches and armchairs and reading lamps had been moved to the foyer, and the foyer was nowhere to be found. It was a new apartment, totally unfamiliar, like I'd never been there, like we'd never happened. It smelled like vanilla candles instead of what it had smelled like before. Wood, linseed oil, incense. Only the bathroom was exactly the same. I used her tweezers to slit the dirt from under the nails of my fingers and toes, and I scrubbed my body as hard as I could to get the grease off my skin. All my clothes I washed by hand, and the water ran like sewage for 10 minutes straight, and I just couldn't go on. I threw everything except my coat under the sink. I dried myself with a towel, and in the mirror a tripod covered in skin revolved, pretending to be my body. Footnote. This is a reference to the Nubian writer Saif Daif's 1968 surrealist novella, Mourner in Space-Time Continuum, in which the protagonist is serially metamorphosed into such varied objects as a boot, a tripod, and a tuk-tuk. My bones were rod thin and rod long. I hid my scariness in her clothes and came out shivering. We hugged then, but she wouldn't let me kiss her like I used to. When I tried, she bowed her head into my chest, and that was all. My hair dripping on her like a tree after good rain, and the two of us as fragile as birds. I fished out of my coat pocket, a gift I had been carrying with me for weeks. A Palestinian coin from 1939 I'd found on the street, with writing in Arabic, English, and Hebrew curled around its holed middle. She seemed about to cry. She brought out a few more blankets, but didn't invite me into her bed and did not go herself. I was asleep within minutes, my head in her lap.
The boy from Shubrakhid told me he weighs 58 kilos on my bathroom scale. I fed him the food I'd cooked for William the night before and prayed he wouldn't choke on it. Footnote: there is a superstition among Arabs that a meal prepared for a spouse or lover can turn poisonous if eaten by anyone else. He ate slowly, as though thinking through the quinoa. When I woke up, alone on the couch, his shoes were gone, but his clothes were sopped to a pulp in a corner of the bathroom floor. I went into the bedroom, but there was no sign of his having been in there. The bedsheets were twisted, just as I'd left them after my last sexcapade. William's leather jacket hung incriminatingly over the shoulders of a chair. His deodorant on the vanity, his texts lighting up the phone I'd locked in a drawer. 2 nights later, the boy from Shubrakhid called. I unblocked him, asking if I was hungry. I met him at the Ehwa under the bridge, and we walked to a nearby alley where I bought us sandwiches of breaded chicken and Turkish cheese fried in black oil. It was the first time since he'd reappeared that I got to look at him properly. There was an unhealthy smudge, as of pencil lead, all over his skin, and it hurt to see the gauntness of his new face. But he was in high spirits. As we ate, he told me how he'd spotted the same motorcyclist we had once seen together, who drives around downtown with a man-sized Rottweiler sitting on its tail behind him, its paws on his shoulders, and how this time it stole a cigarette right out of his hand. "Who did?" I asked. "The dog," he answered, and we cried on the ground laughing. What is Cairo? What is life? "I swear to dog, the god stole it out of my hand." And then he kissed the back of my hand and I had to look away. It wasn't funny anymore. I have to be gentle now that I'm refusing him. But there isn't a gentle way to say no to a man who knows he is being told no and continues in a pleading manner. We drank coffee after coffee until finally I said I would have to go home. He wanted to walk me there, and I couldn't decide if it would be crueler to stop him then or later, so I let him walk me to the gate of the building. He tried to wish me flowered dreams, dreams of honey. He tried to say these things casually, but the words came out too soft as I took the shining key and unlocked the lock and said goodnight and closed the grated gate behind me.
Does she not know? Is there any possibility she doesn't know? I see her 3 or 4 times a week now, but always on my own initiative. I work her pity like a bow saw, lengthwise, violining with a hand against the bones of my own throat. When I phone, her heart can't deny me. She cancels plans with other people, and we meet at the Ahwa or at Zigzag. And it is almost like it used to be. Except that at the end of the night, she goes home and I don't. But does she know this? When we part, there is always money in one of my pockets, and neither of us acknowledges the transfer or the fact that I've been downgraded from lover to charity ward and am living off her beneficence like the stray dogs on Champollion. She feeds me but won't hold my body close to hers. She won't hold my body close to hers because she feeds me, like the goose, all tender and no tit. Footnote: an Egyptian saying that refers to a girl who doesn't put out despite signals to the contrary. It was popularized by the 2002 film Elimbi, starring Fifi Abdul. "Will you do me a favor?" I asked last night, reaching for her hand just as she was leaving, and I saw, it was clear to anyone, that her yes was full of dread at this ask that required commitment before the full measure of the ask could be revealed. It is a feint at the patron's pocket to see if her hand will flinch. A test not of her generosity, but of her guilt before my boundless love. Can she trust me to toe the line? To respect what we are and what we are not? Or will I ask for too much? Will my greed, or worse, my need, face-slapping, hair-tearing desperation bubble to the surface and expose the charade we have been acting out since that night I failed to rescue her and was rescued myself instead. She chewed the inside of her cheek and waited to hear what I wanted from her, looking like a child about to be reprimanded. Adorable. Almost too much to bear. "Don't ever let anyone photograph you in digital," I said, her hand still in mine, but limp and unhappy there. Your body was made for the screech and grain of old-fashioned film. It was the first time in months that I had referenced her nudes, the nudes she still believed I had. Her breath caught in her throat like a sleeve on a door handle, as if she was only now realizing how vulnerable she might be. Was I blackmailing her? I smiled. She breathed an embarrassed sigh of relief, and it was all the information I needed. There is no way she doesn't know where I go to sleep at night.
"Where are you going?" I asked yesterday, and he buttoned his coat without looking at me and then said, "Well, you're going home, right? Work tomorrow? British Council, bright and early, fraternizing with the enemy?" It was an old joke between us, and he didn't mean it to sound so bitter. Every time he speaks, even if he gets the words right, his tone outs him as a thing in pain. I tried to save him with my own levity. "Yes, that's where I'm going, but where are you going?" He smiled and said, "Do you need anything? We dare each other." I dare him to answer me, and he dares me to ask the question one more time. I ask again and again, and he changes the subject. Yesterday, I went one further. "Are you going home?" I said. He raised his eyebrows and left without reply. At first, I saw him a few times a week, but now it is almost nightly. At first, I gave him tens and twenties that he might mistake for his own, lucky change forgotten in a pocket from long ago. When he didn't object, I began to give him fifties. Then yesterday, when we hugged, I slipped into his coat £1,000, and he still didn't say anything. This has become our routine. We eat something cheap together, and then part innocently, like we used to in the very beginning, before he ever set foot in my apartment and got comfortable there. If I want a night off, I have to put my phone in airplane mode. Otherwise, if I see his call, I'll answer. And if I answer, I'll go to him. There is something I owe him, though I don't understand what, and this debt is a gentleman's tie around my neck, requiring ballroom manners, that level of care. As soon as you begin rejecting a man, you have to be twice as polite. There's a danger between us, but I'm not always sure who it belongs to. Which of us needs protection and which of us should be afraid? Tonight, my phone is in a drawer, not ringing, and every sound from the stairwell is cause for panic as William drips his sweat into my open eye, onto my exposed throat, as he shifts his grip from my shoulder to the headboard for better anchorage. I hear the whine of the elevator door and clamp my hand across his mouth instinctively. He's surprised, but then his smile begins to feed from my palm like a cat. He thinks I'm playing with him. Lifting my legs over both of his shoulders, one by one, he speeds up, heaves harder. He licks between my fingers, his tongue peeping through the gaps. The fool cannot register terror on the face of a woman he is actively loving. The fear is crying from my eyes, a trail moving out across each temple, crawling down around my head until it wets the back of my scalp and the pillow beneath me. William continues to hammer at me, and the word I hear in the dark of my dissociation is labor. The man is laboring at you. He hammers into you like this is his job, like he gets paid to hammer. An attitude so different from that of the boy from Shubrakhit, who always turned off the lights or closed his eyes during sex and went somewhere far away. In the hallway outside the door, silence. William finishes loud and clear all over me before rolling off.
The knock comes a few minutes later. By this time, William is on the balcony scrolling through his phone, and I'm standing, 1 foot out of the bathroom, 1 foot in, ready to wash the stickiness off me, the smell of sex thick in the air.
But cocaine goes so nicely with murder. That's what Megdi said on the phone when the unthinkable happened. I was walking down Sharif Street to pay my rent at long last, 2 months of it anyway, when his voice, that cream white effeminate hello that haunts my dreams, puffed out of my jacket pocket like a spritz of perfume. I hadn't heard it in 6 months, since June. Hello, hello? The phone hadn't even rung. Disoriented, I ducked into an alley to answer. Hello? And his voice was so familiar, it seemed to spring from inside my own head. How much? He said immediately. Megdi? Did you call me, or... I checked my phone. I'm sorry, I must have called you by mistake, I tried to explain. Does it matter? He quipped. How much? I should have just hung up then, but I tried to make conversation with him. I was desperate for an exchange of any kind, the American girl having made herself unreachable since the day before. Funny, today of all days I have a little money on me, but actually, Megdi, it would kill me to score, I started to say, when Megdi interrupted. But cocaine goes so nicely with murder. Footnote. In Cairo, one of the street names for cocaine rhymes with murder, making this a popular proverb to indicate that a user of the drug will remain one until it kills him. He laughed and told me to meet one of his boys at the central bank, which was not far from where I stood at that very moment. Bewildered, thinking, look what God has clashed together. What are the chances I should be here at the very moment my phone remembers Megdi and chooses his number from any number of numbers, and that I should have just enough money in my pocket when it does? I've always trusted in guiding signs. After all, what kind of God would string together this many serendipities only to lure me to harm? I crossed the street. I looked alive.
It happened. It happened as it was always going to happen, and it happened quickly. One of those moments when you are pushed outside your ordinariness into a drama where you do not belong, and the drama is full of accidents, and the accidents full of repercussions that are grossly disproportionate. You strike a nail with a hammer and the whole building comes down. Me? I was the one that caused all this? I looked around me at the ruins and could not comprehend that they were mine. No, please, not this. It was excessive, imaginative, punishing in a way that only fiction could or should be. This is the shape of narrative climax, but what is it doing in my life? For a week afterward, I had to be told every few hours where I was, who I was, and why I was there. Reem moved into the apartment to keep me alive, and then the ifs came, and they never left me. If only I had allowed the boy from Shubrakhit to call that night, instead of throwing my phone into a drawer. If only I had answered the phone, even just to say no to dinner, I'm not feeling well, I'm on a deadline with this grading, anything at all, he would not have come to my door. And if he had had to come to my door, if only he had knocked and left. If only he hadn't said my name through the wood, but he said my name. He knocked a second time and he said my name, and I knew from hanging out the laundry that morning that it was cold outside. He was still wearing my clothes under his coat, and I was not wearing my clothes at all. There was no time to save anything. He said my name, so I came to the door wearing only a t-shirt that doesn't belong to me, imagining I could de-escalate the situation if I kept my body out of view, but the door banged open. He pushed right past, didn't even notice the shirt or the stink in the air. He turned into the empty bedroom. He moved to the kitchen. He moved to the living room, the bathroom, back to the bedroom, like a murder verb looking for its object, and I followed him, pleading but too afraid to reach out and touch his arm. For a moment I knew, or thought I knew, which of us the danger belonged to. Back to the living room, to the dining room and its balcony where William had just laughed out loud. It happened quickly. The boy from Shubrakhit charged at him, and William, shocked in the water glow of his phone, doubled over in time to catch his speed over the shoulder, pick it up by the knees, and tip him over the balustrade.
Part 3. Instructor sits at the head of the table. On his left are Minnie, Alex, and Laura, and on his right are Tim, Noor, Jacques, and Candace. They are all facing one another in a loose circle with sheets of paper and pens before them. Laura has her laptop open. Candace is helping Jacques choose from among several shades of hair dye he is ordering on his phone. Noor flips through a printout in front of her, looking bored and resigned. The lighting is fluorescent, academic, and the air conditioning is on blast. Instructor.
All right, everybody, it looks like it's just the seven of us today. I'm assuming you've all read the piece?
Several nod.
Laura, you didn't print, but did you...
Laura. Trees.
Instructor. Trees, right, that's fine. Just CC me your written feedback so I have a copy. Anyone else saving the planet today?
Jacques and Tim shake their heads. Alex smiles.
Great. So we're workshopping Noor this week, part 3. Very heavy stuff. I think I speak for all of us when I say, ouch.
There's a polite chuckling around the table.
Noor, you want to read an excerpt for us?
He nods as he asks a question.
Yes?
Go ahead.
Noor.
She picks up the stapled pages in front of her and begins to read. It was when I put my phone in airplane mode, permanently, that I realized there was no one left for me in Cairo. All begin flipping through their own papers, looking for the section being read. For weeks, I would wake up to 15 missed calls on my phone, from Rish, the British Consul, the cleaning lady, unknown numbers that I feared were the police, or worse, someone from Shubrakhit. I didn't answer any of them. Alex pushes his page toward Minnie, who is still flipping through her own printout, so they can share. The only people I wanted to talk to were the ones who Skyped or FaceTimed me anyway, because they were halfway across the world. And yet, when I talked to them, there was nothing to say. I felt the ocean between us. Elijah was campaigning for Bernie Sanders, but I couldn't remember how I was supposed to react to this. Lulu had recently discovered Love Island and called wanting to gossip about season 2. And my mother was drinking too much. They had no idea what had happened to me in Cairo, and I couldn't tell them. What could I possibly say? A boy is dead? A boy from a village you've never heard of is dead because of me? It would take too long to explain. And in the end, I knew their verdict would be generous and unfair. I could already hear their voices sympathizing, commiserating, assuring me against all evidence that I had done nothing wrong, refusing to listen or understand. The prospect of their forgiveness was as dreaded to me as the prospect of accusations from Shubrakhit. So I kept my phone in airplane mode. And when I spoke to friends and family in the States, I let them tell me about their hookups, the shows they were binging. Had I heard Drake's new single? Would a man bun suit Elijah? Did I know the meme with the two Kermit frogs? Until one day my internet cut off in the middle of a sped-up tasty video for vegan goulash. I needed to make the monthly trip to the Vodafone outlet to pay my internet bill, but I couldn't. There was no reason I couldn't, but I couldn't. I hadn't left the apartment in weeks and had been living off delivery apps that brought food to my door. The thought of facing the men on the street and at the Ahwa, the doorman, the dry cleaner, the fool maker, the kiosk owner, the banana seller with his cart on Champollion. I had even started drying my laundry on hangers in the closet so as not to have to open the balcony shutters and let in the horrible light. When the video froze, my first thought was, finally, a way out. It was as though I had been waiting for a moment when I couldn't leave the building, so I would have to leave the country. It occurred to me simply, that I would never need to visit another Vodafone outlet if I got on a plane to JFK. I would never need to cross 8 lanes of roaring traffic, terrified for my life, only to duck into a junky taxi with no meter and no seatbelt, and be lectured the whole ride about the religious rulings against cross-dressing and the importance of women looking like women. I would never again need to be asked by a waiter or a plumber or a stranger why I had a buzz cut and where I was from. I would never need to struggle to explain myself in Arabic or be followed by street children selling tissues, calling me a faggot. If I wanted to, I could never again see anyone who had heard of the boy from Shubr Khit, or anyone who'd heard of Shubr Khit in the first place. I could just call Egypt Air and book a flight home. Noor finishes reading and continues to stare at the page for several seconds before flipping the printout back to the beginning. Instructor. He pauses respectfully. Thank you for reading that, Noor. Good choice of excerpt. And such an emotional delivery. Really, very moving. Candace. Yeah. Hearing it out loud is so powerful. To Noor. I was reading this last night in bed and kept wanting to call you and just be like, are you okay? Several people around the room nod. I mean, I know this happened over a year ago and you mentioned last time you're in therapy, but I can't get over how traumatic this must have been for you. Alex. Yeah, and to go through it all alone. Candace. You must have been relieved when he died. I know that sounds horrible. Laura. It's not horrible. It's realistic. Candace. Yeah. My aunt Lemma was married to her abuser for 14 years, and even after he went to prison for assaulting Darnell, that's her son, they have 2 sons, she still couldn't sleep because she was terrified he'd get out or send someone to the house to kill her. She moved halfway across the country and wouldn't tell anyone where. She used to call us from payphones like it was the 90s. Anyway, her insomnia only went away when she got to see the body. Laura. Makes sense, honestly. Alex. Wait. How did he die? Candace, knifing, I think? Turning from Alex to Noor. But what I'm trying to say is it's so brave of you to return to this place and really excavate while the ground is still wet. For a lot of people, it takes longer. Instructor, I think we can all agree with that. It can be easy to revisit these memories, but I hope and feel quite certain that this is the best way for you to process your time in Cairo. The violence of your relationship with the deceased. Give it language. Take ownership. But, smiles, why don't we get going? As usual, once everyone is done giving their feedback, Noor, you'll have a chance to respond to any comments or ask questions of your own. He winks at Noor. Please refrain from jumping in until then so you can hear the impressions of your readers without paratextual input. He looks around the room. Right. Minnie, let's start with you. You always have something to say. Candace, Jacques, and Alex smile. Minnie. Right, so the ending isn't working for me at all. All laugh. Minnie. No, really. I know you all think I have a problem with every submission, but that's not true. No, seriously. Instructor. Guys, let her finish, please. They quiet down. Minnie. I mean, part one was structurally weird enough. What with no paragraphs and the perspective flipping back and forth. It was really hard to follow, plot-wise, and just left so many questions unanswered. Literally, these questions that have nothing to do with the actual events, and I know Noor wanted it to be... Instructor. Hey, let's try not assigning intent this time. Minnie. Okay, well, whatever the intention, it just feels unnecessary. Like, I get it. She's trying to experiment with form. But you can't be swapping voices that frequently and jumping around temporally and then also have these koan riddles at the top of every page. Why are we even getting his voice in your memoir? To Noor. How does that even make sense? You and the boy's head like that when the whole point is that you don't fully get each other? You're from different worlds, etc. You said last time you were trying to humanize him, but honestly, for me, all these alarm bells start going off. Like, I just become suspicious. And I know you. If I didn't, like if I just picked this up at a bookstore, it's asking a lot from readers you've never met. Especially when there are logistical obstacles and inconsistencies we're expected to just swallow, like, how do you know he was stalking you if in the memoir you didn't know he was stalking you? Same thing with the drugs and rape fantasies.
You said he made up things about Cairo and his family all the time just to mess with you. But then you carry on reporting what you heard, so we don't know what to believe. Like, are we getting the fact-checked version, or... Everything is potentially tainted, especially when the footnotes come in. Obviously, I'm not trying to tell you about your own culture, but I Googled a few of them and... Instructor. I don't mean to interrupt you, Minnie. But we did talk about the footnotes last time, and also the alternating voices. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the third part, the last part. Minnie, I'm getting there, I swear. Instructor puts his hands up in playful surrender. My whole point is just that in parts one and two, having to maintain this level of skepticism the whole time, you're really hoping for a big fat payoff as a reader to justify all that labor, you know? I was waiting on the third part to bring everything together, give me that aha moment. But in the end, I just found myself even more confused. I don't mean to sound rude, but why were you grieving so much? There was so much guilt, and I kept thinking, am I missing something? Did I misread the balcony scene? Did you push him or something? I kept... Laura, under her breath, wow. Several people look aghast. Minnie. Going back and checking if there was a confession I missed somewhere. And then why didn't his family come to claim the body? What kind of a family would take this news over the phone? These questions are directed at Noor, who, because of the gag rule in workshop, cannot answer. There were just so many basic plot points that were unclear. And after enduring all the experimentation of parts one and two, flipping backward and forward, I was really hoping all my acrobatics would pay off. But they didn't. They just didn't. Alex. Can I step in? Instructor. Please. Alex. Well, I don't want to harp on, because we talked about this so much when we did part two, but I just want to repeat that I'm Team Footnotes. Really glad you took our advice after the first workshop and added some stage whispers for us. If anything, they made me trust you even more. I didn't have the same skepticism thing as Minnie going on. Just really enjoyed the intel on Middle Eastern culture. Laura. Same. Alex. And like vaginal teeth? Whoa. Amazing. I think if anything, we should get more of those friendly asides, and maybe also more sensory detail. After all this time, I still don't know what downtown Cairo looks like. Is it skyscrapers? Are there markets or malls? What are the women wearing in the street? And like the village? Shobrakit? Shrugs. I can't picture it at all. You have to remember, we have zero references, so unless we're given a shit ton of description, we're probably going to get it wrong. And how sad. Like, what a waste that would be. As an Egyptian, you have access to a culture we never get to experience at this proximity. In English, I mean, straight from the source. So there's real opportunity for, I don't know, excess? He tosses a handful of imaginary confetti. I think you can afford to celebrate more of the little stuff that's un-Googleable. All those textures and kinks that make Cairo, Cairo. You're already using some of them in the footnotes. I just think there's room for more. But anyway, yeah, part three. My issue with part three is tied to my issue with the work as a whole, and it has to do with the emotional investment we have in the characters, especially the boy from Shobrakit. We still don't know his name, right? Or did I miss that? He flips through his pages. Minnie. No, we don't know his name. And that's another example of the confusion I'm talking about. Like, we really need something solid to hold on to here. Looks exasperatedly around at everyone. But sorry, Alex, go on. Jacques. To instructor. But can she even say his name? Instructor. What, legally? Jacques. Well. Minnie. Either way, though, she could give him a fake name. Instructor. Legally, the dead are fair game in most states. Minnie. To Noor. So you could name him, really. Call him anything. Call him Ahmed. Instructor. But even if he were alive, so long as the account is honest, so long as it is descriptive rather than malicious, you have nothing to fear. Legally speaking, there is only one rule. If you write anything negative about a living person, it better be true. For stories of abuse, the victim, or survivor as we say now, looks pleased with himself, has every right to tell her story. Tim. Or his. Instructor. Or his! Right you are, Tim. His, her, they. Juries are extremely sympathetic to victim testimonies, even without tangible evidence. There's an implicit understanding that accounts of abuse are most likely true. Success rates for defamation suits are very, very low. They are also, I mean, well, It's expensive to take someone to court, so that's another barrier. Usually celebrities can, high-profile politicians, but otherwise, Jacques. Right. So, Alex. Right. Minnie. Fat chance for him. Instructor. To Alex. But you were saying? Alex. Right. I was trying to say the boy from Schoberkeet isn't too sympathetic from the beginning. Laura. He's abusive. Alex. Exactly. I just found it hard to grieve for him in the way that the speaker does in part three. All her guilt feels a bit alien to me, which is, I think, what Minnie was also trying to say. Minnie. Yeah. Laura. I agree 100%. I'm not saying the Schoberkeet guy deserved to die, but I think he did it to himself. His chauvinism was killing him from the beginning. The first time they are alone together, he rapes her. Candace, nodding to Noor. You said no. Laura. And even after that, he was oozing toxic masculinity and red flag behavior. I mean, all of part two is about him becoming a stalker. And then suddenly he dies and she's all brokenhearted. Obviously, I'm not trying to tell you how to feel, to Noor. But he was so manipulative, even when you two were together. Leeching off you, isolating you from the people that cared about you. I don't think you owe him that heartbreak. I'm not sure how you can position yourself in this work, but I think it needs to be clearer that you're not responsible for what happened, especially today, considering the moment we're living in with hashtag MeToo and Brett Kavanaugh a few months ago. I just think we have to be really careful about the stories we tell and where we cue for violins. Who are we asking the audience to identify with? How do we manage blame? I don't know about you guys, but personally, I was relieved when the Schoberkeet guy died. I mean, this is a man that was entertaining the most violent fantasies about you. To Noor. And then told you, or at least I'm assuming, how else could you know? He spent months spying on you, following you to and from work, trying to engineer a life-threatening situation just so he could swoop in and save you. He blackmailed you with your own nudes, Candace. Revenge porn. Alex. He also stole from you. Instructor. Do we know that he stole from her? Laura. He totally stole from her. How else could he have paid for that first relapse? When he goes up on the bridge? Minnie. Wait, he stole what? Laura rolls her eyes involuntarily. Alex. In a hushed voice to Minnie. We're talking about the pearls. Laura. And also, if you think about what took the Schoberkeet guy up to her apartment in the first place, I mean, the night he dies, he went up there because he found out she was sleeping with William. He was going to murder William when he accidentally fell off the balcony himself. Minnie. How did he find out about William? Alex, she's extrapolating. Laura frowns. It's in the language, Minnie. Minnie. Well, I just think that's the sort of thing that needs to be clear. If half of the people reading don't realize that the guy is a thief and a murderer, that's a problem. Laura opens her mouth, but Minnie plows on. It's a problem in the language. Instructor. Thank you, Minnie. I think you've made your point. Can we return to the question of the speaker's grief for a moment? I want to remind everyone that this is memoir, not fiction. And it is the special power of memoir to archive our most private personal dramas, for which there is often no other place for safekeeping. Meaning, you don't have to approve of how the writer remembers or processes the death of someone she knew. We are not here to therapize. We are here to listen and bear witness. Candace. That's exactly what I wanted to say. There's no wrong way to feel. When someone falls off your balcony and dies, you're entitled to whatever coping mechanism works for you. Laura. Well, Candace. Every response is equally valid. Laura. Well, sure, but if a victim resorts to self-harm or self-blame... Candace, she's allowed to write about it. She shouldn't have to pretend it didn't happen. Laura, Candace, that's not what I mean. I'm actually on your side. Also, sorry. Raises her hand with the elbow resting on the table and looks at instructor. Can I disagree for a moment with something you said? Instructor, of course. Beaming. Laura. Okay, so last year when Mac Miller overdosed, everyone blamed Ariana Grande for breaking up with him, saying she pushed him over the edge. Everyone knew he suffered from addiction, but still held her responsible for allowing him to die. And that reaction didn't just come from nowhere. There's a whole precedent in the literature, in the media, like the way tabloids talk about women. And it's not just tabloids. I mean, it's a bigger problem, obviously. but we demand all this emotional labor from them. We reward loyalty and punish women for choosing independence, for choosing survival, actually. Candace, softly. Laura, there's this script, like a social script, and it keeps women trapped in these destructive relationships because they feel guilty leaving. I just think as writers, we have a hand in shaping that. I'm not saying we should all write manuals like How to Leave Your Boyfriend or Get Out Alive. But at the same time, our writing isn't just floating in the ether, mimes a butterfly with one hand. We need to hold each other accountable for the narratives we perpetuate. Don't get me wrong. I love this memoir project. I think it's so, so important. But if we're going to have this account of a girl who blames herself for the death of her depressive, possessive, extremely violent ex, I don't think it's too much to ask for a little more self-interrogation. Like, where does that guilt come from, and is it fair to her? Turns to Noor. Are you being fair to yourself? Candace. Yeah, I totally get what you're saying now. The rape, too. We don't really get enough of that. Laura. Exactly. It's like she suggests it, but then doesn't address it head on. The last thing you want your reader wondering is if you were raped. It just undermines the whole... I mean, there's an ethical dimension here. We can talk about craft forever, but we also have to ask, is a narrative like this, nodding at her laptop, normalizing cycles of abuse? Is it perpetuating misogyny? There is an impressed moment of silence. Candace nods slowly. Instructor. All good points. He looks around at them all, beaming still. Tim clears throat and says politely to Laura, if this had happened to you, how would you grieve? Laura, personally, I would grieve as though my psychotic stalker rapist had just died before he could kill anyone else. But I'm not even saying Noor isn't allowed to feel bad. I just think she was probably also relieved on some level, and I couldn't find her relief on the page. Instructor, Tim, why don't you go next, seeing as you asked the question? Or Jacques can go if you need a minute to collect yourself. Tim jumps a little and looks around at Jacques, then at instructor, unsure who to address. Tim, me? Should I go? Instructor, please. Tim, he clears his throat again and looks down at his papers before speaking very quietly. I didn't really write any comments about the speaker or her grief. I was more interested in her friends from the cafe. Instructor nods encouragingly. Tim. Well, so in part three, after the boy from Shobrokits falls off the balcony, there's this whole dark self-loathing period. He begins to tick events off his fingers. The speaker tells William she never wants to see him again. Then Reem moves into the apartment to take care of her when she stops eating. Sammy also starts coming by the apartment to check in on them both. And within a few days, she finds out Sammy and Reem started a rumor that the balcony death was a suicide. Then she cuts him out of her life, too. Alex. They don't really start the rumor. Tim's ears flush immediately. Instructor, please, Alex, let him finish. Alex, sorry. Instructor, nods and smiles, mouthing to Alex. It's fine. Tim. I mean when the crowd gathers around the body, the two of them start telling everyone he was just some homeless guy, just a junkie who probably jumped off the roof. It's all just, you know, it's a bit unfair what people start saying about the Shobrokits boy. Candace. He was a junkie, though. Tim. Well, Candace. And homeless. Tim. Right. Candace. I think it's important to just, like, to call a thing what it is. If he was sleeping in the mosque, he was homeless. If he was shooting coke, that's a junkie. It's not some exaggeration meant to discredit his life. It's, like, a truth of his life. A straight-up fact. And hard enough to admit about someone you loved. Her voice cracks a little and the room goes quiet. Tim, honestly, I didn't mean... Candace. And maybe this is a race thing. Like, maybe that's why I'm taking this so... I just think, as a woman of color who's been systemically gaslit by men my whole life, I think being honest with ourselves and naming even those we are closest to helps us see them and see ourselves. Especially when it's a black man or whatever, Arab, Muslim, there's just so much stereotype. Like, you don't want to call the cops because they already hate black people. My aunt Lemma, it took years, and even then... You don't want to admit he was a crackhead because it's what the reader expects. and you want them to be wrong. But also, sometimes they're not wrong, and you're only hurting yourself when you hide the truth. It's like what Laura was saying about women. Part of what keeps us in these patterns is the feeling that our abuser is unique, that he's not like others, and we have to protect him from the judgment of a world that doesn't understand, close to tears. When actually, Tim, very flustered. Definitely, no, you're right. I'm not saying he wasn't any of those things. Candace, it's not your job to prove he was good. When you're honest about the person, even if the drugs are part of that, you have to. You just have to. Tim, I see your point, really. I was just thinking more of Sammy and Reem, but I see your point, totally. There is an uncomfortable pause while Tim tries desperately to make eye contact with Candace. Instructor. Okay, I realize this is a very personal topic for many of us. Candace stares at the door. But I'd like to invite everyone to take a deep breath and remember that it can be as difficult to share as it is to receive. Minnie gives him a small interruptive wave. Yes, Minnie? Minnie, I get what Candace is saying, but the drug still didn't make sense to me. How is he a cocaine addict and also that poor? Instructor smiles kindly. Good question. Maybe we need more info about the price of cocaine in Cairo. Laura, you know, to Tim, I realize Sammy and Reem didn't intentionally start the rumor about the suicide, but I think the boy from Shobrakit had a death wish anyway. Alex, yeah, I was just going to say, it's actually the closest version to the truth they could give an angry mob in that moment. They even explained afterward that it's only by bringing up the drugs that they were protecting Noor from accusations of murder. Laura, and William. Alex, both of them. They're the only witnesses. And the case is already weird enough. A random white guy and this Egyptian girl on a tourist visa claim a homeless guy was in their house. Laura, apartment. Alex, right, some apartment belonging to some German academic, and the homeless guy fell from the balcony and died. Who's gonna buy that? The whole neighborhood shows up and no one buys that. Immediately, it's that mob mentality, everybody shouting. Fucking machetes come out. They've got William by the neck. And the police are totally useless, ready to arrest anyone. To Noor. Maybe we need more cultural context here, but I think it helps to remember that this is not Manhattan. It's downtown Cairo, military state. There's political tension. It could turn into a bloodbath easily. So, like, I understand why Sammy and Reem start telling people about the drugs. They might have saved Noor's life, actually, or spared her, whatever. Months in prison. I feel like they knew what they were doing. Instructor, okay, interesting. Tim, where were you going with your point about Sammy and Reem? I want to let you finish before we get swept away. Tim. Well, he glances nervously at Laura's laptop. Candace is still death-staring the door. Well, I see Alex and Laura's points, but I just didn't feel it was fair what they said about him. Even if it was true. Even if it was, you know, tactical. The rumor might have been helping Noor. But it was hurting the Shobrakit boy more than he deserved to be hurt, he frowns. They flattened him. Instructor, so you weren't too sympathetic towards Sammy and Reem? Tim, no, I thought they were the problem, maybe, and I can understand why Noor cut them off when she heard what they'd been saying, and why she went a little, you know. Her guilt makes sense to me. It starts with the rumor, not with the accident. She doesn't feel responsible for the boy's death. She feels responsible for his character assassination. Glances at Noor. I think. Sammy and Reem, they made him out to be totally worthless, like just a nobody they didn't know, had never sat or smoked with, someone who didn't even deserve a proper police investigation, and that, actually, that's the problem. Maybe Noor should have been interrogated for murder. Candace's head snaps in Tim's direction. Maybe she needed to be investigated, even if she was innocent. Maybe the fact that the police don't even suspect her or William, like, says something about why he died. Candace, in disbelief. Well, your alliances are clear as fucking daylight. Tim, no, Candace. Arrest the survivor? Tim, I didn't mean it like that. Candace, have you ever been stalked? Blackmailed? Tim, no, you're right. Candace, Have you ever had furniture thrown at you? Have you ever been raped? Tim, it was just a thought about Candace. I'm so tired of men. She tilts her head back and blinks at the ceiling, looking truly exhausted. There's another uncomfortable silence during which Tim looks at instructor pleadingly. Jacques.
Same.
Candace is the only one who laughs, but this diffuses the tension considerably. Jacques puts an arm around her, and his earring immediately catches in her hair. They spend several moments disentangling. Alex, quietly to Tim. You were talking about class? Tim. He looks at Alex with a bewildered expression, as though surprised anyone had been listening. Yes. Candace sniffs loudly. Tim. Power and, yeah, class. Minnie, looking from Tim to Alex. Are we saying Noor killed him? Laura. Metaphor, Minnie. Minnie. Because if anyone killed him, and I'm not saying anyone did, but if anyone killed him, it was William, right? She lowers her head like a bull and bucks. He sort of picked him up and sent him over the balcony, right? Isn't that how the boy from, I'm not even going to try to say it. The village boy, isn't that how he dies? Instructor, hastily. How do we feel about William? Good of you to bring him up, Minnie. I don't think we've talked about William much or his role in the balcony scene. Laura, I don't know. White, cishet, British male, walking around like he owns everything. It's not clear what he's even doing in Cairo. Alex, colonial vibes for sure. Tim, maybe it's not clear what Noor was doing there either. Laura, what's wrong with you today? Instructor, quickly. Jacques, what do you think about William? We haven't heard your voice much. Laura and Candace exchange a look of disbelief. Jacques, mon Dieu. Several laugh. An instructor is visibly relieved. Instructor, well, I'm glad we agree on something at last. Anything you'd like to add to that? Jacques. He waits for others to finish laughing before speaking. Just a few things. For me, there was also too much labor. I think paragraphs would be good. Why not? Some quotation marks, maybe? To make the dialogue easier to follow, because italicization, it is not always enough. The switching voices, he frowns and tilts his head from side to side. Sometimes clear, sometimes no. Minnie raises hand and vote. Hard agree. Oh my God. Jacques. But my main feedback is, we do not need the third part. Instructor. Oh? Jacques. It is very difficult to follow such a climax as the balcony death. From the beginning, it was like a thriller. We were, how you say, holding our breath. Why not end there, at the top? He mimes an airplane taking off with one hand. Then the subject is clear. It is not about Cairo. It is a deadly romance, like Giovanni's room. Instructor raises his eyebrows and looks around at the rest of the group, who all look at one another in turn. Tim, in particular, is noticeably excited. Instructor, Tim? Tim. I think that would be respectful to both parties. Candace shakes her head. Instructor, Laura? Laura, well, I think respect is irrelevant here. But if losing part three means we don't normalize victim blaming, I'm all for it. Better to let the events speak for themselves. Candace. So long as we keep the event of his death. Instructor. Candace, go ahead. Candace. I just think we need to see it. Like, the description of the body. That whole part with the angles of the bones. As someone who was deeply triggered by the scenes of abuse and sextortion, that closure was important for me. Just knowing Noor is finally safe. Laura. Yes. Alex. Yeah, it's a pretty radical suggestion, but now that you've mentioned it, Jacques, I think I agree that part three doesn't add much. Jacques. It makes the manuscript less, opens and closes his palms like two halves of a book. Symmetrical. Alex, can I just say, turns to Jacques, you always have such extreme revisionist suggestions, like, here's what you don't know about your own work, imitating Jacques' accent. Charlie is one share video away from transitioning. The mother ran over the dog on purpose, and the whole thing should be rewritten as a libretto. All laugh. But I appreciate it. Instructor, I think we all do. Minnie. I still think having two voices doesn't make sense. Instructor. Okay, then. Buoyantly ignoring Minnie. If nobody else has anything to add, we can turn it over to the writer herself, who has some very exciting news. May I? Winks again at Noor, who looks uncomfortable. I received a call this morning that Noor has been offered a publishing deal for this manuscript. This one, smacks the copy in front of him, that we've been reading for 6 months. Candace. Woo! There are expressions of excitement and low hooting from everyone. No one looks happier than Instructor. Alex, smiling. Not surprised. Instructor. She wasn't going to say anything, but I insisted. To remind us all that good things can come from our grimmest hours. That if we face our traumas and trust in the healing power of narrative, we can produce work that is valuable, even marketable. He snorts to indicate the joke. But seriously. More seriously to Noor. Though you are just beginning your journey with this memoir, the fact that you have already managed to touch so many readers is a testament to your fortitude as much as to your craft. It would have been easy to leave Cairo behind forever, but instead you continue to return there every day to remember the city, the violence, and the boy himself, who is the dark heart of your book. Almost worth it now, wouldn't you say? The end. We hope you have enjoyed this production of If an Egyptian Cannot Speak English by Noor Nega, narrated by Amin El Gemel and the author. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for listening to Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.